all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Terry Tanelian from the RAND Corporation. Terry, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me back, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, last time we talked about a report that you were one of the named authors on out of RAND Corporation called Ready or Not, Assessing the Capacity of New York State Healthcare Providers to Meet the Needs of Veterans. And I think we provided a lot of good information to our veteran radio listeners. So we wanted to have you back. But before we get into the specific reflection that I'm going to ask you to do, let's remind our veteran radio listeners that you got your bachelor's in psychology out of Boston University and your master's in psychology out of American University. And can you tell us a little bit about what your role is at the RAND Corporation?
Sure, happy to. So I've been at RAND now for 18 years, and I primarily focus on doing health-related research on military and veteran populations. I have done some other studies looking at the quality of mental health care for civilians and adolescent populations in particular. But since coming to RAND, I've had a primary focus in understanding the needs of the population that serve in our military, both while they're in uniform as well as after, looking specifically at how those challenges of military life affect their families, and then also trying to understand how our systems, if you will, both benefits that are provided, but the care delivery systems are situated to address the needs that the population may have.
Well, you're a unique talent here in that you are really a national expert in this field, and you come to it with the ability to research this and come to conclusions based on sort of the nature of RAND Corporation. Tell us about what RAND Corporation does in this space and if they have a political bent one way or another.
Sure. Well, RAND is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. So we are really, we exist to provide kind of evidence-informed solutions. And so we tackle complex research and analytic problems for a variety of sponsors. We have a long history of working very closely with and for the Department of Defense. We work for several other federal agencies as our research sponsors, but we also have sponsors in the private sector, private philanthropies, as well as some corporations. We have a very strict kind of quality assurance process that promotes the rigor and objectivity that all of our studies are expected to achieve. We also have, we're very careful about any potential perceived conflict of interest. So we are, and have a large focus on a public transparency mission. So we prioritize publishing all of our work and work very carefully with our sponsors to ensure that that will occur so that we can make sure that the evidence that we generate gets out into the public view so it can be used to inform decision making by multiple stakeholders.
Well, I think it's really important for our veteran radio listeners to understand that the RAND Corporation's mission here is really sort of pure research and analysis and to be an umpire to call balls and strikes as you see them without any real influence. Is that an accurate statement?
That is an accurate statement, and I like the way that you phrased it. And I will tell you, working here over the years, I have delivered findings to several high-level officials that they haven't liked, but they have valued and trusted to know that we tell it like it is, and our results are based upon a rigorous study approach and go through a very thorough quality assurance process so that they can trust and rely upon them, even if perhaps they aren't very happy with the findings.
Well, I think it keeps your integrity in place when an organization does that. And honestly, for most clients, I certainly run into those instances where I know I'm giving them the advice or legal opinion they don't want to hear, but it's the right answer. And in the long run, I think that's the best thing you can do for your client or in your instances, the sponsors. So. Let me go to the document that sort of started all of this for me, calling you and saying, hey, Terry, can we do a 10-year reflection back? And that is, in 2008, you were one of the principal authors of Invisible Wounds of War, Psychological and Cognitive Injuries, Their Consequences and Services to Assist Recovery. Now, that's a really long title. most of the titles out of the RAND Corporation are. But what I want to remind our listeners is, if you think back a decade, you probably saw this research reported widely in the general press, and it's probably this research which implemented into people's thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan and IED explosions.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything else, this research, I think, brought to the forefront the challenges that our men and women were experiencing. So talk to us a little bit about how groundbreaking that work was in 2008 and summarize it, if you will, for us.
Sure, absolutely. We were very interested in trying to understand from a societal perspective what the impact of deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan was on recently returned troops. There had been some news reportings and some papers in the scientific journals that looked at some specific Army and Marine units, and we're starting to find some concerns around the rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. And then we also had a number of task forces that were looking specifically at the issues around IEDs and traumatic brain injuries. And so, you know, early in the 2000s, about the 2005-06 range, we started hearing, you know, signature injuries, PTSD and TBI being called the signature injuries of these conflicts. But there was very little empirical information available to really understand the true size and scope of these particular types of injuries and how they were affecting service members. And so we had the unique opportunity to be funded by a private foundation. So that gave us the ability to look from a societal perspective, as I mentioned, to kind of not look at it through the lens of the Department of Defense or the lens of the Department of Veterans Affairs, but to look at it from the population and societal perspective. So we wanted to understand the size and scope, how common was PTSD among those who had deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. We also looked at depression. We included depression specifically because of the concerns that started to creep up in the news media about suicide among personnel who were deployed and personnel who had recently returned home. So we wanted to also include depression among the conditions that we studied. And then we also were looking at the incidence of traumatic brain injury. So how often were service members experiencing a probable TBI during a deployment? And we didn't just want to count how often these things were occurring. We wanted to understand what were the consequences that may be associated with them. So what do we know? What lessons could we learn from veterans of prior eras? What could we learn from the broader literature about the potential consequences of having PTSD, depression, or experiencing a TBI? So what might happen over time in increased rates of substance use or increased rates of family problems? So we wanted to be able to tell the story about why does it matter and why do we pay attention to these numbers, not just because they occur now, but because they can be associated with other problems. We also wanted to be able to tell it from a business perspective. Sometimes it takes dollar figures to get policymakers' attention. So we wanted to calculate the economic costs associated with having these conditions among the population. And then we'd also place a focus on, well, what can we do? Like, what types of treatments are available to address these conditions? And to what extent do the systems of care that are in place now in the United States deliver those treatments, so that we could identify where there were gaps and make specific recommendations for how we might be able to address PTSD, depression, and traumatic brain injury among returning service members. So we were the first, really, to kind of generate these estimates from a large population-based representative sample of all of the troops that had deployed through that time. So for the first time, we were able to calculate, you know, really the true size and scope. We also were able to put a dollar figure to it. And so we were able to calculate that the cost to society in just 2 years post-deployment of having PTSD or depression among returning troops was, you know, over $6 billion. We were able to also model that if we close the gaps in care and ensured that all those that experienced PTSD or depression got high-quality, evidence-based care, that we could reduce those costs to society. And then we outlined a series of recommendations of specifically how to close those gaps. So it did really kind of rip the Band-Aid off, if you will, in understanding the extent to which these consequences of deployment were a burden, not just to the individuals experiencing them, but to their families as well as to society.
That research that was out there, again, this is 2008, a decade ago, really drove home for people that a substantial number of the troops who were deployed into theater, and it was something like 20-25%, experienced some sort of TBI and PTSD or depression. And I think both the percentage surprised everybody at the time, and certainly quantifying it and saying, hey, this is costing you about $6.2 billion with a B dollars.
In just 2 years. Those were in 2007 dollars. Those costs would be different today.
I think that just shocked people at the time. I think it shocked the general public at the time. Did you get at RAND Corporation any feedback or pushback on those kinds of revelations?
Yes, we got both, you know, high praise and, gratitude from really the community that is designed to support veterans as they come home, because this helped them understand the size and nature of the challenges, but also, suggested a pathway towards real solutions. But we did get pushback. We got pushback, you know, really in a number of ways. I think people were both surprised, but they were concerned that we were creating a public health problem where one didn't exist. And we were shining a spotlight maybe where people didn't want spotlights shown. So we did get a lot of pushback. But, you know, we stood behind our estimates. We stood behind our recommendations. And over time, we've seen additional studies really almost validate our estimates. And to this day, we still know that there are continued gaps in our nation's ability to address these issues, and our recommendations really have stood the test of time, that most of the effort are still designed in those same areas that we identified.
Well, I think this kind of research again, it takes a special organization and set of researchers to have the credibility to put this out there, helped shape for veteran service organizations, mm-hmm. veteran advocates, certainly for family members of veterans, to look at this situation and realize, A, I'm not alone. B, maybe I ought to reshape some of my services because this is a big problem. Even to the point, and you talk about it in your October 2017 report, Bridging the Gaps in Mental Health Care, mm-hmm. there's a huge dollar associated with loss of an individual's productivity because of these mental disorders, whether it's they completely can't work or they partially can't work, there is really a big economic impact to the family and to the nation as a result of this as well, isn't there?
There is, and in fact, you know, that is one of the reasons that when we modeled the economic costs, we wanted to, you know, kind of do some microsimulation modeling that would allow us to change the assumptions and look at what would happen to those costs if we just made some changes in the system. So if we increased access to care, if we increased the quality of care, would it change that? And that was really where we saw we were able to make the business case for closing gaps in access to high-quality care, because we were able to demonstrate that if you did that, you could reduce the cost of society. Not only could you create better outcomes for the individual and for their family by reducing the burden that they experience associated with these conditions, but we would save money as a nation. We do talk about in the original study that it would require investments in the treatment system, but over time and long term, those investments would help us reduce the overall societal costs associated with these conditions among troops. And so, you know, while these figures were, you know, stark, and I think, you know, a big surprise for folks, we also recognized that we didn't model other consequences. We didn't include the costs associated with substance use disorders or addiction, and we didn't include costs for some other types of health problems or issues that individuals might face. So we think that our estimates may actually have been pretty conservative with regard to the true costs of these invisible wounds.
I think this work probably helped fertilize the efforts of a lot of philanthropic organizations, service organizations, medical organizations. You've referred to them in your Bridging Gaps in Mental Health Care as Welcome Back Veteran groups, who I think heard about this big problem and said, we have to step forward and do something. As you reflect back over this last decade and look at what has been done, as you did in last year's report, do you feel it's, you know, have we covered the problem, or do we still have miles to go?
We have miles to go and then different challenges. And so after the release of the report, and certainly even before the release of the report, we began seeing important investments at the federal government as well as in the non-governmental sector and even some state-level governments. And so there was a response, you know, from Congress and large, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars put into new programs, new requirements to hire more professionals and to really expand capacity to change the delivery systems of what was happening in DOD as well as in VA. And so those investments were really, really important and very critical. And, you know, Congress really responded with specific expectations and mandates and really changed the way that some of these things were addressed, you know, at the federal government level. But then we also did see, you know, the sea of goodwill, as it's been referred to really stepping up to create a number of programs and major investment in support programs for families, but also in specific clinical service delivery efforts. And the one program that you're referring to in the report that just came out was the Welcome Back Veterans Initiative, which was a grant-making program partnership between Major League Baseball Charities and the McCormick Foundation out of Chicago. And so that, like some others, you know, really invested in creating centers and clinical services to treat veterans with PTSD or depression with high-quality evidence-based care. And then also those centers, many of them created services for the family members And in addition to kind of interventions, also created some other outreach and supportive services. And so those, you know, back in 2008, if you were to do a Google search or you were to try to find resources in your community or even in your region outside of the government, you would have a hard time finding something. Now we've gone kind of in the opposite direction where there are a number of resources and a number of programs that are available, but navigating them can be challenging. And so now we're talking about not just having to navigate what DOD or what VA might offer, but all of the different types of programs and interventions and clinical services that could be available in the non-governmental private sector. And so while we still have a ways to go in ensuring access to high-quality care for all veterans who experience some of the invisible wounds of war and others, like substance use disorder, like military sexual trauma, all of those other types of conditions that may be related to their deployment or to their service that also, you know, warrant attention. Now we've got the added challenge of trying to create more coordinated navigation and integration across all these systems. It's not just what we outlined as the major players in 2008 is DOD and VA, and they still are really, really important players and doing and providing some really critical services. But the population is also turning to these non-governmental entities, and how do we ensure that those are delivering high-quality services as well? Because many of them may sit outside of the traditional accountability mechanisms that we have to ensure that the right thing is happening for veterans in those settings as well.
Well, there's no shortage of issues to research and continue to focus on, and I think the work that you're doing is important for policymakers and those interested in these topics to kind of get a clear-eyed view of what's really going on. And listeners, we're talking to Terry Tenelian, who's a senior behavioral scientist at RAND Corporation. She really is a national expert on military health policy research. Terry, if there are people out there who say, I want to dig in deeper and understand what's going on in this space, how do they continue to follow the work that's being done in this military and veteran health space?
Well, that's a great question, and so I would encourage folks to check out the RAND website. If you were to go to www.rand.org/veterans or even veterans.rand.org, you'll come to a landing page that will feature some of our work that we've been doing, not just in looking at the health issues and mental health issues in particular, but we've also got a number of resources and reports that we've done around veteran education, veteran employment, and family support. We've done a lot of work specifically on military and veteran caregivers as well. So those who are providing informal care and assistance to our wounded, ill, and injured service members, both from physical as well as non-physical kind of injuries for our veterans. And so we've got a lot of resources there. There are a number of other organizations that also have resources, but again, that landscape is very broad and diverse, and so it can be challenging to know exactly which might suit an individual's needs, but we do have some resource collections on our website as well for folks to try to find some of those other organizations.
Well, I want to encourage people to go to rand.org, www.rand.org. You'll find just a treasure trove of really well-written reports. They're easy to read. The facts will jump out at you. The graphics are good, and the work is very solid. So we encourage our listeners to dig a little deeper in that area. And Terry Tenelian, we want to thank you for again being on Veterans Radio, and based on all the good work you're doing, I suspect we'll be talking again.
Well, I look forward to it, and thank you so much, Jim.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.